This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. One night, Evie Carter returns home to find her husband has been shot and killed in his home office. Her response? Destroy his laptop. She's immediately arrested for his murder. Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren is on the case. Warren remembers that Evie Carter was also cleared more than a decade earlier in the accidental shooting of her father. Does lightning really strike the same location twice? And what does confidential informant Flora Dane know about Evie Carter's husband? Jackson, New Hampshire author Lisa Gardner's new thriller unravels this mystery. It's called Never Tell, and it's out in stores next week. I spoke with Lisa Gardner at her home in Jackson. Well, I guess we could start, and I'll start by saying, Lisa Gardner, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Peter. NPR is just amazing. It's one of my favorite radio stations, so it's fun to be included.
certainly glad to have you as a listener. So while reading Never Tell, one of the questions that kept coming up for me, and I think it may have kept coming up for you, is the idea of the monster.
Yeah. Right?
Especially with the character of Jacob Ness. He says he was a monster. He did monstrous things.
Yes.
But he said he didn't like being a monster. And so it made me think about the nature of that kind of evil. Is it, are you born with it? Is
yeah.
it made? Where do you fall on that?
So it's interesting to me. Someone once said that we read suspense as a kind of mental preparedness. We all hope, certainly in our lifetime, we would never meet a predator or psychopath. But still, being surrounded by news stories where the worst seems to happen, there is some kind of vicarious thrill to reading these novels and thinking, okay, maybe if I understood monsters better, if I encountered one, I would know what to do. And I certainly think for me, every single suspense novel I've written has been trying to answer this fundamental question. What is a monster? What is the nature of evil? From what I can tell, working with a variety of law enforcement contacts, it really is a spectrum. There is the evil that's made, the cycle of violence. In my free time, I do some work with at-risk kids. I think that's the kind of evil we actually have a chance to make an impact and a difference on if we had better social services. But there is also the evil that's born. Ted Bundy is a great example. I think Jacob Ness, he wasn't interested in reform. He wasn't interested in being anything different. If anything, to me, he was whiny that why wouldn't society accept him for who he is.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he whined that he didn't want to be a monster, and yet he was, and it didn't seem to make any efforts to reform
yeah.
himself. He just kind of embraced the monstrousness.
It's interesting to me how many lifelong criminals, particularly when you read a lot of the FBI profiler interviews that they did in the 70s, really feel like they are the victims. Like, it's just one of these kind of interesting things that they victimize so many people, but really, if society would just accept them, if they were better understood, you know, they're in the wrong.
Sounds like what you're getting at is the idea of empathy and where people fall on their capacity to feel empathy.
Absolutely. Now, what's interesting when you read about long-term abduction scenarios, because I did a lot of research for Flora Dane's situation. You know, she was kidnapped and held for 472 days. And Never Tell is the aftermath. What does your life become after that? Is that for all his monstrousness, like a lot of those long-term abductors, he was capable of nice things. Like he brought for her favorite movie or TV show. She liked Grey's Anatomy. They would play games in the car. When you read about like the three girls that were held forever in Ohio, I mean, basically he had pizza night for them. He would sometimes reward them with alcohol, and they'd almost pretend they were a family. Because the other interesting things about most people, predators who identify themselves as monsters, is they're also really lonely. And some of these long-term kidnapping situations are their way of basically trying to force a relationship because they're just not capable of a normal one.
Oh, that's a fascinating interpretation, because what you were describing made me think that maybe these people want to convince themselves that they're not all bad. So
exactly.
Look at the good things I'm doing with Pizza Night and with this movie.
Well, a lot of it is they want total control. But they also, again, they don't want to be the bad guy all the time. They want like anyone else to be liked. And part of one of the things Flora does that enables her to survive, but it gives her a lot of guilt afterwards, is she becomes Jacob's friend. She listens. She becomes his confidant. She becomes someone he wouldn't want to let go. Because the truth is, every day he's threatening to kill her. And at any moment, he could. He has that kind of power. And a lot of survivors will talk about that's how they endure. And really what Never Tell, what some of these books are about, is the psychology of survivorship. A lot of the things you do to get by are also the same things that make you feel guilty later. Why didn't I resist? Why wasn't I more difficult? And when you really talk to a lot of experts, they will tell you, because then you would be dead. You survived. That is strength.
Right.
Don't second guess.
Flora makes a firm distinction that I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor.
Yes.
Why do you think stories of survivors are so fascinating to you?
I think we all want to know what it takes, and would we ourselves have that courage? But the truth is, we are surrounded by these really high-profile cases in the news. You know, Jamie Cross is her last name, right?
Remind me of this case.
Jamie, she was the one, she just got rescued like a week ago. Her poor parents were killed in the middle of the night.
He took her, hid her
under his bed with weighted boxes, and she just freed herself. So she's now is joining also this very small, very elite club of survivors. And given the extent, like again, this is a story that's just gonna get played out in the news for a while, and we're surrounded by it, it makes us anxious. And one of the cures for anxiety is feeling like you have an answer or a solution, or feeling it can be survived. So I think a lot of examples like Elizabeth Smart, I mean, she's become such an amazing example of someone who is stronger, who's become this fabulous advocate for victims. And when you see someone like her that has gone through such a terrible ordeal, but she's pulled her life together, she's done these absolutely just riveting media interviews where her strength of character just shines, it kind of gives you hope for all of us.
This story has a variety of, I don't know if twists and turns are the right words, but perhaps the best thing is, the best way to describe it is just a lot of facets, right? You've got this crime in the present, you've got the crime in the past, you've got a variety of different characters coming into the story for different personal motivations. I'm wondering how you keep track of all of that, because it seems, I mean, you make it comprehensible very easily in the book, but I imagine putting it together is quite difficult, but maybe not. What do you think?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I'm one of those writers they call a pantser, writing by the seat of your pants.
Meaning you don't have a plan.
I don't have a plan. I do a lot of revision work. But in this particular case, most of my books have been written on something in real life. And Evie Carter's character was based on a real life case. I believe the only mass murderer we have had in the U.S. who's female. And the case actually originates in Massachusetts, Amy Bishop. So when she was young, she accidentally shot and killed her older brother.
Mm-hmm. And then she went on to shoot people who were colleagues at her university in Alabama, right?
Yes. Yeah, so like then 30 years later, 20 years later, she was denied tenure at a university, sat through an entire meeting, at the end of it pulled out a gun and opened fire on everyone. So the New Yorker ran this fabulous article on it. Did she get away with murder the first time? I mean, it feels like these two events have to be connected. I mean, what are the odds that you have someone who did an accidental shooting when she was young and then becomes, again, to the best of my feeble knowledge, one of the only mass shooters that's female in the entire United States? And the article was really well done, because the question is, we don't have an answer to it. She herself cannot answer it. I mean, she pled guilty. She still swears the first shooting was accidental. But there were some interviews with her parents that were absolutely chilling, in that they were almost so New England. They gave the same answer almost word by word over and over again, till you're like, all these years later, I think no one actually knows what happened that day with her brother. They've repeated a story to themselves so many times. If it wasn't the truth, it is now. And I believe they could pass a polygraph, anything they've turned it into. But she spent another like 5 years living in a house, sitting at the kitchen table right where her brother died, his room untouched. The New Yorker somewhat implied, is this what happens when you don't resolve trauma? I mean, she didn't go through any of the work that, ironically enough, Flora is going through. Who am I now? What does it take to be human now? Her family did the kind of whitewash. We're just going to pretend this never happened. And then, of course, something way worse happened. But that psychology is what I love. And that became the basis of this book then. One woman, two accidental shootings, or two shootings. Like, I mean, again, what are the odds?
Is that where you usually get story ideas from the news?
Yes. I mean, like, so Find Her, which is the first book with Flora Dane, clearly, sadly, we've had so many long-term abduction cases. But actually, what really got the story going for me was because we're getting all of these crimes, the FBI has started a whole new division, and that now has carried through many of these books, for victim advocates. Because when you have these huge long-term situations, you need something like a plan for reentry. I mean, it used to be, particularly in suspense, you caught the bad guy, the story's done. But these mass casualty events we're having, things like these long-term abduction cases, terrorist attacks, these are not things, I mean, often we even know the bad guy. It doesn't make it the end. It's the beginning of a whole nother now process, healing, story. The law enforcement aspect, the trials, honestly, for some of these cases take years. So the FBI and law enforcement are even now having to adapt to this whole world order where arresting is not the end and families really do need support and someone to help them even understand. And what do you do when People magazine's now parked out on your front lawn? What do you do when Entertainment Weekly saying, you talk to us, or, you know, no one will ever hear your story again? I mean, you also become almost a celebrity. How does a normal person going through such a trauma deal with that? And these are all very real world issues now. And they're the kind of things you read articles on and they fascinate me. And fiction is how I work them out.
What was your career, your job before you started writing fiction full time?
So I am unique for suspense novelists. I wrote my first book at 17.
Oh, fantastic.
I sold it when I was 21. So I've actually been at this 25 plus years now, meaning I don't have a lot of real world experience. I have to hope this writing gig works out because I'm not sure I'm employable.
Pretty sure it's going to work out for you, I think.
I worked briefly as a research consultant for a major consulting firm right out of college, because even though I was published, all writers will tell you, in the beginning, it's for love, not money.
Certainly.
And one of the big things I learned being a research analyst that has helped me in my career is research. And in particularly back in those days, because I'm so old, this was pre-Google, you called to get information. There was no database you could enter into. And one of the first things they taught us as research analysts was to cold call, because they were, in consulting, you're always trying to accrue business information, and the only way to get it is to call, and really, now we call it social engineering. You know, play nice, try to see if you can get someone to talk. When I went to write my first thriller, one of the things that came up was, you have to do research now. People want the story to be kind of over the top, but they want the procedure to be real world. The reader wants to feel they're in an authentic universe. So, I mean, I come from accountants, so it's not like I had a Rolodex of people to call. But thanks to being a research analyst, I did. I cold called the FBI. I actually, this isn't a great example, but I cold called Walpole Prison and said I wanted to write a book where a serial killer escaped prison. Could they, you know, help me learn how? That didn't go over well. That's not the appropriate way of cold calling.
We'll help you figure it out and then broadcast it to
everyone. So I've gotten better since then.
Well, I did want to ask you about an aspect of research. The acknowledgments in your book say you work with the Carroll County Sheriff's Department.
Yes.
For this. How did they help you?
So a lot of just basic investigative techniques. I had some excellent contacts in Boston, and Nevertel is actually dedicated and even refers to this fabulous detective, Wayne Rock, who sadly passed away from cancer a year ago. And he was often my go-to. He and I met probably, 10 years ago, when he was a detective with the Boston Police Department, and his loss was very sad. So often I have a lot of just basic investigative procedure, and the Carroll County Sheriff's being local is often a great place to start. I also love how the Sheriff's Departments work in New Hampshire. We have a very unique structure. We have one of the most empowered Sheriff's Departments in the United States because we're so rural.
Well, what are they allowed to do that?
Well, so
other
they can
can't?
Actually write up warrants and execute them on their own, with the acknowledgement being that they are sometimes too far away that by the time you got back to a courthouse, filed an affidavit or warrant, and got all the way back, the moment would have passed. Now, they're still held to high standards. Later, if the warrant is not properly written, it can also be thrown out. So it's on the one hand, it sounds like the wild, wild west. On the other hand, they're held to the same legal standards. It's just like most of our sheriff's investigators have to know the law. And they will tell you in their free time, they're reading legal articles as much as, say, articles on evidence search or proper protocol. The other thing I love about New Hampshire policing, again, because it's a lot of rural situations, is still a lot of kind of true old-fashioned interpersonal skills for detectives versus, you know, D.D. Warren will tell you, being a Boston cop, there's cameras everywhere. And it's kind of both one of the best and worst things that's happened to policing. You can really actually, if you want, spend all your time behind a desk scanning images. And yet you also have to, as we get more data and data available, there's also a lot more combing through it to do versus, you know, the old fashioned days where you've got a suspect, you've got him in the interrogation room and you just grill them.
The problem we all have to some extent, right? So much information, yes. The effort's now trying to figure out which information is most relevant to what you're trying to do.
Yes.
So a question about what you just told me about the sheriff's office and how it would relate to fiction. So because New Hampshire is unique and because it makes it easier for the police to sort of do their job in one particular way, at least I think it makes it easier, it eliminates a key step. Does that make it sort of not great for fiction?
Well, if anything, it makes them have to be more knowledgeable. So often when I, you know, contact them, they can even give me legal answers as well, because they always have to know both sides of the equation, which... And also, they have some interesting, what I like about them is they have interesting workarounds. Because again, if you're going to be on your own a lot, and you might have backup that's 2 hours away, I like to argue our New Hampshire law enforcement are very self-sufficient and kind of almost the MacGyvers of police. They also don't have the toys. In fact, what was it? I was talking to one of the lieutenants, and he's like, for the last like sting operation they had, all the departments had to... basically did an email loop till they could, each department had one piece of equipment that if they pulled them all, they could actually pull off the sting operation. Yeah. So again, there's a certain amount of ingenuity, and I like that for Dee Dee. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no great fiction writing in, and then for 4 days, you sat in front of a computer monitor and stared at videotapes.
Yeah, I can't imagine that's compelling.
So this, how do you get answers faster? How do you get someone to talk using, again, just plain old interpersonal skills? I think that is more exciting. And I like the cleverness. I do think in New Hampshire, our law enforcement, they have to be smart. Their resources are not like what a major urban department has. And readers like smart. I think it's one of the first contracts when you're writing suspense novel for a reader. The police have to be doing their best work. No one wants to be reading some novel. Well, and they screwed up, and that's why the bad guy got away.
Mm-hmm. They're smart, but they're also human. Like, Dee Dee is human. Like, she's got a family, or her husband and her kid, and their kid's dog. I mean, she's got that vulnerable side, but she's doing her job quite well.
I like to write characters that are relatable because, again, the situation in a book like Never Tell, a pregnant woman who shot her husband and may have even shot and murdered her own father years ago, hopefully that's not something we can relate to. Hopefully that's unique. But so therefore you want the characters to feel real. And it's fun to throw in, Detective Dee Dee is such a workaholic. And she is so confident in that domain. Her challenges almost by definition have to be personal. What's it like to have a child? Because she wasn't really planning on that. I mean, she wouldn't change anything. But being a working mom, particularly with her hours, has thrown her for a loop. I like to incorporate tidbits from real life. I do a lot of work with my local Humane Society. I have a rescued dog. And Kiko, Dee Dee's dog, and her new nemesis, is actually named in honor of dog that was rescued by the Humane Society. The couple involved gave a nice donation to the Humane Society to have Kiko memorialized. And they just find it endlessly fascinating that now he's in the fictional world running around eating. She is running around eating Dee Dee's shoes. And as Dee Dee's husband puts it, who's it going to take longer to train? The dog not to eat the shoes or you not to keep them on the ground where the dog can't eat them? It's a toss-up.
So tell us about how you went about naming a certain character in this book, because apparently there was a contest for a reader to name a character. Tell us about that contest.
So absolutely. If you go to the website, lisagardner.com, each year, so it's up and running, I run the Kill a Friend, Maim a Buddy sweepstakes.
Kill a Friend, Name a Buddy?
Maim,
M-A-I.
Yeah, they don't always die. Sometimes I maim them.
Okay.
Some people have been dismembered. What was it? One of the winners years ago, she's like, yeah, definitely kill my husband, but make him a badass first. It's like, okay. And I had someone who killed himself, but he wanted to put up a good fight. So it's like, okay. So if you go to the website, you can nominate the person of your choice. It's a very popular sweepstakes, I have to say. Every July, a winner is chosen. And sometimes dying, sometimes maiming. Every now and then, not a lot of people are killed in the making of the novel. Or I had a woman a year ago, she actually wanted to honor her daughter and she didn't want her daughter killed. So we made her daughter a neurosurgeon. It's meant to be fun. It's meant for everyone to have fun.
How does that change the relationship you have with your readers, if at all?
I think it's nice when you can offer up something that's fun and interactive. And it's always interesting to me, if you go to writers' conferences, you want to hang out with a suspense novelist because we by far are the most fun. And I think suspense readers have by far the best sense of humor. So
why is that?
I don't know. I think it's we spend so much time, you know, in fictional homicide. In real life, we're much more chill.
Well, I'm going to AWP next month, so I'll see if I can find the suspense writers.
We're the loud, rowdy ones at the bar.
Well, Lisa Gardner, thank you very much for letting me into your home and speaking to me about your work.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such an honor and thrill. And thank you guys for making the long drive up here to the mountains.
That's Lisa Gardner. Her new novel, coming out soon, is called Never Tell. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Lisa's bookshelf at our website, nhpr.org. We are always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you. You can send them in by email. The address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at @nhprbookshelf. And I want to turn now to Rachel Cohen. Rachel Cohen is a new addition here at NHPR. She started last month as an intern helping out with All Things Considered, and she helped produce this Lisa Gardner conversation you just heard. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
So, Rachel, what are you reading lately?
I'm reading Small Fry by Lisa Brennan Jobs. It's a memoir.
Okay.
So Lisa is one of the daughters of Steve Jobs.
The founder of Apple.
Yes. And the book is about her growing up. She lives with her mother, and she doesn't know her father too well as a young girl. So it's about her close, interesting relationship with her mother and kind of the lack of her relationship with her father at that age.
So you're reading not necessarily to learn more about Steve Jobs, but you're learning about the experience of what it's like to sort of grow up with a distant father.
Yes. And so it's about Lisa and her mom, and it's about this character, I guess, who we think that we know well, Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple. We know him through the media and the news, but at the time, Lisa didn't really know him, and so it's a way to look at, to give a new, I guess, perspective on things that we think we know, but we don't actually know much about.
Small Fry by Lisa Brennan Jobs. Thank you very much, Rachel. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And again, listeners, if you've got recommendations, send them to us. The address is books@nhpr.org. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks very much for listening.